Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, my special guest is Esther Salomon. Esther works full-time for animal justice work. She dedicates her time towards understanding and building people-powered organizations capable of creating transformational change. Esther, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. It's nice to be here, Simon. It's nice to talk to you.
Good. We met on some panel about activism, and I thought it'd be really great to hear what you're doing. So you're focusing on animal justice. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I am, and I think it's a really interesting place that I've ended up actually. And I don't think when I first started to become politically minded that I would end up here in animal rights. But I think what kind of drew me to it was just the, you know, because I had already, started to understand like gender inequality, social inequality, economic inequality, race, environmentalism. I think I was kind of on that train and thinking about those things. But I think when I came across this question of, you know, how should we treat animals and how should we be towards animals? And I kind of found out about what was happening to them and how we treat them. I think I was struck that something that is so normal and that I thought was so normal and that I partook in, was actually really wrong and was actually, really against my values. And I think at the same time, it's kind of an issue that is, is quite neglected or not thought about in the same way as other social justice issues are. And then I think also there's just something that draws me to it. There's, something in my heart that draws me to it, as well as, all of the logical things as well. I've definitely been on a journey with it over the last couple of years, kind of going from just change, like dietary changes, to getting involved in activism, to really being a part of that community, to really understanding like the scale of the issue, how it's kind of tied in with capitalism, neoliberalism, like the move to like commodification, individualism, like how it's tied in with all of those other things. So I have definitely been on a journey with it.
Sounds like a journey. I mean, let's stay with animal rights a bit. I mean, I'm really interested kind of what it does to people when you kind of raise a topic, like coming onto this interview with you, this podcast with you, I immediately started feeling guilty. It's like, and I've been a vegetarian since I was 21 years old. And that was more kind of a political act because children in Biafra were starving. And I was reading that we were kind of shipping grain from kind of African places to kind of feed cattle in Great Britain. And like, this just seemed completely wrong to me, So my kind of thinking was political, and I'm not a vegan, and I was thinking about kind of, yeah, what's kind of your reaction as an activist in that space? Kind of what do you kind of experience yourself from others, you kind of when you confront them with these big issues?
Yeah, there's a real like variation of different responses, and I think what's interesting about this issue is that, I used to eat animals, I used to use animals, I used to, see them in a really materialistic way as well. So I was doing that as well at some point in my life. And so I can remember that, and I can remember how I was thinking and what I thought. And so, you know, when I talk to other people, I have to kind of keep that in my mind of like, you know, I was thinking in the same way as they are at some point in my life. Yeah, it's kind of a mix of things. I think, you know, and I can only tell you what I've experienced in my life. You know, these aren't facts and statistics and things. But I think it's interesting when I broach this. Yeah, when I talk about this with people who are already quite like aware of different issues and involved in things or active or whatever, because I guess they already have a sense of themselves as like a good person, as a person who cares about things, as a person who's active. And so then being confronted with something that they might not have thought about before, you know, comes as like a bit of a challenge to their identity. And then with folks who are not active, or, you know, aren't like politically minded or, you know, are interested in other things. Yeah, that really depends. It can kind of, sometimes it, you know, there's a real curiosity to understand more. Like sometimes I find it easier to talk to, you know, somebody who doesn't know anything about like social justice issues or anything. Sometimes it's almost easier. You know, because there isn't all this, you know, there isn't a charge to it, or there isn't like all of these other things to think about. But yeah, I mean, it ranges from curiosity to defensiveness to anger to, you know, like everybody's kind of different in that sense. But yeah, I think what's difficult, you know, for people when they start thinking about animal rights is, you know, I imagine it's a number of things, but yeah, I guess this idea that like I am a good person and what's being shown to me right now is questioning that sense of myself or that idea of myself, you know. But you know, I like to remind myself that, you know, it's not people aren't bad. It's just the things that they do might be bad, you know, like good people do bad things.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, in the psychoanalytic world, we kind of have this idea of the good self, and the good self will be defended at any cost. It's like, you know, if you attack my idea of Simon being a good person, then I'm going to kind of fight back with everything. And it's usually kind of unconscious defenses, like, you know, you rationalize things, you kind of come back. And so I imagine that you carry quite a lot when you kind of, you get that reaction, like, you know, as a group, you know, you, I first came across animal rights activists back in the, I don't know, I was very much an activist in the '80s, you know, we had the miners' strike and we had kind of feminism was kind of on the rise. We had, there's a lot going on, you know, Thatcher years. And one of my activist friends was part of ALF. I don't know if you ever came across ALF, the Animal yeah. Liberation Front.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they were like the ultras. They were like, you know,
they're a big part of our history.
Yeah, they were the ultras. It was like they were the real kind of hardcore activists. It was kind of, it's an awakening for me. And it was like you say, I'd never even thought about it. You know, I got brought up in a English diet. You know, sort of meat and two veg, and you know, and then I became vegetarian, and then like, you know, that the question of kind of wearing leather and how animals get treated. It was huge. And I actually hang out with the Krishnas quite a bit, the Hare Krishnas as well, and that was interesting because they kind of got me thinking. And I did go vegan for about 9 months because they talked about the karmic kind of you know, this mass killing of animals, and they kept on saying to me, you know, don't you think this like has an impact on the world, that there's just this mass killing all the time, this kind of, you know, even in the dairy production. And it really impacted on me that, you know, and I actually think it is. I think the way we kind of imprison animals and treat them so, you know, almost torture them and kind of kill them kind of in such a mass way. If you see the kind of the big factory farms in America and in Eastern Europe and, you know, and across Europe, it's like, you know, how can we kind of as a civilized people do that without having some impact on ourselves. And I think it does relate to kind of how humans treated humans. You know, it did kind of awaken me, really.
Yes. Yeah. And this is kind of the essence of it. Really, like, it's the, you know, like, the system that we're living in, you know, anything can be seen as a resource, commodified, mass manufactured, sold, and like, that's what's happened to animals, and the things that their bodies create, is that, yeah, we've taken lives, we've genetically engineered them to be a certain way, we're mass manufacturing them, and that's what's happening to them. And it's you know, like, animal agriculture is a huge part of the corporate food system and the corporate food regime, which kind of underpins, like, capitalism as well. And I think you know, something that you know, a lot of academics on this subject who are interested in animal ethics, you know, make this comparison with like the slave trade, and obviously, like, that's a, you know, that's a sensitive comparison to make, but essentially that's what animal agriculture is. It's a trade in lives. And I think that's what shocks so many people about you know, the slave trade, is that they commodified life, they commodified people, and it's a very, like, it's scary to think about, but it's a very similar mechanism when you think about animal agriculture, trade in animal, any kind of trade in animals, and, you know, and now if we're thinking about environmentalism as well, it's this kind of disconnection from nature or the bigger we, or, you know, whatever that concept might be, but yeah, I think, like, when we kill animals en masse and sever our kind of connection to them, or stop ourselves from feeling compassion towards them, you know, it turns off something in us, like, it turns off kind of like a light in us. And yeah, so it's also like a real spiritual and kind of moral crisis as well, you know. And yeah, you can see how it's connected to environmentalism and this thing of, you know, we have to dominate nature, we have to take control of nature. Yeah. And I think like, over time, even though I had like an intuitive sense of, you know, this is all kind of related, like, I think... yeah, over the last couple of years, it's really kind of solidified for me. Yeah, but it's hard walking around with all of this knowledge, you know.
It is, yeah. No, you carry a lot, and, you know, I'm aware that I push it to the, you know, I still eat dairy, like, you know, I try and eat less dairy, but it's I know that I push my knowledge of what happens in dairy farms and to young cattle and stuff, you know, to an edge, because, you know, we have to kind of carry on day by day, and we, you know, we do our best, but it's like yeah, no, it's hard to carry it. It is hard. And I think it's important to make those links between kind of capitalism and the extractive economy, where we just kind of take from nature, we take from animals, we take, you know, we just kind of use stuff as resources, as commodifications. I think these links are very important, and I also think they're kind of the spiritual links are important. I read a bit on your website, and I was interested in some terminology, and I've forgotten the exact language, you'll have to help me, but it was something around that each individual animal, you actually framed the work you're doing as individuals, and you could have really read it as people. And I wonder, kind of, in your mind, what the difference between human rights and animal rights are there any differences?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and it's difficult because I don't know the definitive answer. And I think like, in the animal rights world, like, there have been some incredible people who have, you know, thought about what would a world look like where animals have rights, where animals have protection. And there isn't like a super clear answer to this, because it's a really difficult question to answer, especially given that given what's happened, given that we've now domesticated many animals, we've displaced many animals. There are many animals who now rely on us. It's kind of like, how do we create a just world from the place, from where we are now? I think, because I think the conception of freedom that we have and that's linked to human rights, I think it's, it's freedom and dignity. And so when we think of animal rights, it's, it makes sense that we kind of take those concepts that we associate with human rights to animal rights. There is definitely this idea of freedom, freedom to live, freedom to your own life, freedom to, freedom from harm, unnecessary harm, like bodily protection, things like that, other things that kind of stand out to me. You were saying that on our website we kind of talk about like the individual, and I think that's that's part of our conception of freedom as well, as like individual freedom. And it's an interesting concept, because I think I also think about collective freedom, and so because I know that the right use freedom and the left use freedom as well. I think they both claim that word and claim that concept, and like God knows where it actually kind of sits. Maybe it sits somewhere in between the two. I don't know. I think like when I think of freedom for animals, there is a sense of we have to respect them as individuals, as individual people, and see them in that way, and not necessarily as just like a homogenous group of like things. I think there is something special in like recognizing the individuality of an animal. And then I think of like universal freedoms that animals should have. Freedom to live a normal life, whatever that might be for that animal, freedom to their own lives, freedom from harm, bodily protection. I think, also there's this issue of like animals are like artificially inseminated. And so we kind of sexually abuse them as well. And so there's, a sense of bodily protection feels really important in that sense as well.
I mean, it struck me, and it kind of it left me with dilemmas, and I don't know the answer. Like I used to read a lot about Indigenous peoples and First Nation peoples and their relationship to animals, and they kill animals, but they kill them in not in a mass destruction way. It's a different kind of a relationship, are animals individuals like humans? I mean, yes, they have individual lives, and that needs to be respected, and there's differences as well, and I don't know, it's an interesting area, and I don't have the answers either. It's kind of it left me really thinking.
And I think as well, I think one of the most important things to me at the moment, and my thinking might change in the future, but I think one of the most important things is ridding them of that property status, because they have property status in law. They're understood to be things, and their property status means that they can be sold, traded, their will can be taken away from them. And it's just that we have to find a new status for them, whether that's personhood in law. So we as people have personhood in law. I don't know whether it's that or whether it's something else. But yeah, that definitely feels important to me.
Do you and your group have a clear utopian future kind of picture, like what it might look like, or are you just kind of working towards in process of improving kind of rights, or do you have an idea, like, you know, if we all were vegan, and because even then you have problems with kind of our relationship to animals and you know, we you know, how we manage our relationship. I mean, I'm very interested in, I don't know if you ever read Donna Haraway's work. I'm very interested in her, how she talks about the entanglements with kinship and our relationship, very much about our relationship with our multi-species companions. And it really moves me. It's like it's trying to shift that relationship from commodification to kind of like companions, and the kind of how do we live yes. alongside? How do we live with?
Yes, yeah.
Plants, animals, you know, the whole lot.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, kinship is an idea that has come up here as well. Like, a lot of us have kind of been talking about it, and you know, we're kind of in the process of thinking about, how do we like articulate this vision of the future that people can think, I want to be a part of that future. I want to help bring about that future. And I think it's something that a lot of like movement leaders of the past have been able to do really well. Like, if you think of King's like I Have a Dream speech, and the way that he articulated his vision for the future in such a beautiful, metaphorical, you know, simple way. You know, I think that's a really like powerful tool that we can use to get people to see, you know, this is the alternative, this is what the world could be. But I think, you know, I think we're kind of still in that process of finding out how we want to articulate this vision. And also coming from a place of not knowing what the future is going to hold, as well. You know, we can't definitively say, this is the way forward, that's the right thing to do. But you know, there are some things that feel obvious, you know, like ridding them of property status, you know, stopping the mass killing of them, stopping factory farming. You know, that's all stuff that we're like, yeah, that's something that we need to do in this generation. And another thing as well is that we want to focus on like systemic change, which is something that like more and more is starting to be talked about in like the wider like animal rights movement. I think in the animal rights movement, we're focused a lot on like individual like diet change, changing what you buy, changing your consumer habits. So there's a lot of trying to get people to go vegan. But yeah, what we're trying to do is we want to ask for like systemic change. So that's change to law, policy, institutions, basically like the rules of the game, is kind of what we want to do, and to kind of create public buy-in and acceptance for those like wider changes. Because essentially, we see what's happening in individual people's behavior as a product of the system.
Yeah. I mean, it's a social construct, isn't it? Kind of, you grow up in a way and you kind of get told these stories and these narratives, and that becomes part of your life even before you start asking the questions. So, yeah.
And how does animal rights kind of fit into, like your view of the world and how you spend your time like doing activism and things like that? Because I know you're involved in quite a few different things.
I am. And, you know, to be honest, I'd be lying to say it played a big part. You know, it's been on my radar, like I say, at different times of my life. And and I'm aware of it. And I, you know, factory farming is kind of like the biggest thing for me. It's like a horrendous kind of practice. But more recently, it's becoming, you know, more aware we're diet wise, you know, we're trying to move away from dairy, and we a bit more, although living in Ireland, it's like cheese and a dairy. It's interesting in Ireland that they, I was going to write something about this, that the NHS kind of has in the UK, the NHS is like a sort of a religion. They talk about the NHS is like a religion. In Ireland, it's the herd. It's like, you know, it's like they're very attached to the idea of kind of small farms and a small farmer and the herd. And it's very interesting to see, like, we have a Green Party as part of the government in Ireland at the moment. They're kind of part of the government, and they're trying to make changes on the basis of environmental kind of needs rather than animal rights needs. You know, they're using that argument, but it's very interesting bumping into the tensions. So it's on the radar much more in like you say, because it's not separate. The way I think about it, it's just part of this whole. It's part of the capitalist system. It's part of the way we treat animals. Kind of really kind of impacts on the way we treat each other. It's like, you know, the way we have an extractive kind of idea of just using resources. You know, so there's a sentient kind of being, a spiritual kind of piece, and then there's a kind of the environmental piece, and then but these things are all connected. So I'm reading Donna Haraway. I'm talking about it more. You know, I'll be talking. I run a coaching course starting this week, and I talk about kinship, and I talk about multi-species companionship. You know, I kind of use that language, and it's something I wouldn't have done 5 years ago. So it's coming. You know, biodiversity issues. Kind of, it's becoming much more present. Even when I'm running a coaching course, that it's part of that. You know. But, you know, hands up, I disassociate, I kind of push it back. I, you know, when I thought about talking to you, I thought, oops, I'm going to be caught out here. Like, you know, I actually eat fish. You know, it's like when I came to Ireland, I didn't eat fish, I didn't eat animals for 10 or 15 years. And then one day I found myself on the Aran Islands, and I was like, I had potatoes and cabbage for 3 days, and I kind of thought, why am I not eating fish? These people kind of are fishermen. They've been fishing here for centuries, and like it felt like a practice which was part of their lifestyle, and it felt like okay, you know. So once a week I kind of I eat fish, you know. So making those kind of decisions is kind of it's a process, and it's kind of making sense of it, yeah.
And I think this is interesting to me as well. It's this like idea of, you know, well, there are so many different cultures across the world that like use animals in a certain way, and it's a part of their tradition and it's a part of their culture and identity. And, you know, and this is not something I know like loads and loads about, but there are so many like ideas and philosophies that have kind of been woven into our way of thinking that support this idea of humans up here and animals down here, and you know, we have the right to use them. You know, there was this idea of like Jesus as the shepherd, as the humble shepherd, and you know, it kind of creates this like idyllic view of like small scale farming of like, you know, it was the time of like the agricultural like revolution. You know, these things are kind of like deeply woven into like our, you know, our development as a species, you know, where we are now. You know, we had to exploit and sell and trade animals to kind of get here. So it's like a part of us that's kind of like a part of our history. But at the same time, you know, I think about like women's rights, and almost every culture like across the world has you know, abused women in some kind of way. And it's the same with animal rights. Like, it happens, all cultures all over the world are kind of guilty of it. And you know, sometimes I hear a resistance of, you know, well, you're pushing this idea onto many different cultures, and this is, you know, it's part of their identity, whatever. But you know, there seems to be no resistance to like going into communities and doing all of this gender work as well. Like, that seems to be okay, and that seems to kind of be accepted. But yeah, it's a global issue, and yeah, it's a massive it's a massive story and narrative, and you know, there's a huge ideological framework as well that kind of supports it.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, you asked me about my thoughts. I mean, one thing I thought for a long time, because I traveled the world a lot, and you see some cultures where the connection between killing animals and eating animals is still very close. So you go to the marketplace and you buy the live chicken, or you choose your fish, and they butcher it there. And so there's kind of an awareness. And I remember many, many years ago saying, well, if I can't kill it, I won't eat it. So I eat fish, and once a year we go mackerel fishing, and I get mackerel and I kill the mackerel and I eat it. And it's like, you know, okay, if I can do that, then it kind of somehow that kind of rationale is like, you know, at least I'm facing up to what I'm doing. At least it's kind of I'm engaged in it. It's not like going to the supermarket and calling it something else, calling kind of cow kind of steak you know, disassociating. So there's something about that. But I also thought very strongly about the challenges of kind of religions and you know, their teachings around animals, you know, like the great slaughter of Eid, you know, when it's like, and then the Americans, the great slaughter of turkeys, like, you know, these kind of rituals which kind of are so entrenched, you know, but yet can change quickly, I guess. I mean, things do change quickly as well, as you know, sometimes we get surprised how fast change can take place. I'm quite amazed how, when I became vegetarian and vegan for a short while, I started practicing making kind of soya milk yogurts and stuff, you know, and experimenting. And it's like really hard to get vegetarian food then. Like now it's kind of everywhere and it's kind of mainstream. Vegan food is kind of much more commonplace now. So you can see quite a radical change happening, can't you, quite quickly, as well as huge problems ahead.
I think I guess like something that's going like well at the moment is like the prevalence of like vegan alternatives. I guess also because like the movement has been like, in my opinion, like heavily commercialized as well. Like a lot of it has kind of gone from animal rights to vegan food and like things that you can buy and stuff. And yeah, I mean, that can kind of be a source of frustration for me, you know, sometimes. But yeah, at the same time, that's an important piece of work that movements have to do. They have to kind of create like alternatives to the current system, you know. And you know, that's something that happens in environmentalism as well. Like there's alternative energy, there's alternative ways to do things, alternative things to buy, alternative lifestyles, eco villages, like, you know, things like that. And yeah, as the animal rights movement, we have to do a similar thing. We have to, you know, build a different version of the future, like ourselves, you know. I mean, that's part of the movement that I think is definitely doing well. But I guess like a reason why Animal Think Tank kind of exists is that, you know, we thought about the movement as a whole and where are its strengths and weaknesses, and like grassroots, like mass action is something that isn't happening, or there isn't the infrastructure for it to really realize its potential. So, you know, this is something that we're doing. Like we want to you know, empower people to be able to take direct action to campaign for animal justice themselves.
So that's your drive. Yeah, before we jumped on this podcast, we were sharing stories. You're living in Lancaster and I used to work in Lancaster, and I was telling you that back in the 1650s there was a lot of subgroups there's a lot of small communities like the Quakers and the Seekers and all these kind of they were anti-royalists. They were kind of they were trying to subvert the kind of the center in London. They're trying to subvert the church, because they didn't believe that the teachings of the church were right. They believed that kind of we all had the light within ourselves, you know, so it wasn't kind of, you didn't have to go to church and get told what to do by some priest. That was a control mechanism. They understood that kind of you know, that you could make some radical changes, and it led to kind of radical revolutions. But it was interesting that kind of they were kind of at the edge of society, and driving this change. And to me, it's interesting. I see parallels with you. You know, you're kind of at the edge of, you know, you're up in Lancaster, up by the Lake District, up by the sea, yeah. in the rainy northwest, and like, you know, but there's this kind of hotbed of activism there. It's kind of interesting.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And, you know, this is something that we're really interested in as Animal Think Tank, is how have past social movements created change? How do people-powered movements succeed in changing their societies, changing their, you know, changing law and changing history? So, you know, we're trying to take a lot of lessons from the civil rights movement, from Indian independence, from the color revolutions in Eastern Europe, and we're trying to apply those lessons to animal rights. Like, how can we do a similar thing? So we've really been influenced by This Is an Uprising, so a book written by Paul and Mark Engler, and those folks have done a lot of work in the US to kind of like unpick those questions, basically. How do we create change in this, you know, current political climate? You know, and they've got huge issues in America around race, around loads of things. So, you know, that's what they're kind of dealing with. So we're drawing, you know, quite a lot from that community. And I think the like Extinction Rebellion, Insulate Britain, recently Just Stop Oil are kind of like the organizations in the last couple of years that have really kind of experimented with like people powered movements, direct action, massive disobedience, things like that. A lot of that does happen in the UK, but I guess those are the kind of big organizations doing it at the moment. So we're kind of hoping to kind of add to that community of practice, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to recommend some reading for you when we get off this. The English Civil War and that period, because it's, I mean, for me, it really inspired me, because I read the civil rights stuff, but it's like, you know, radical change did take place, and it came from the edge, and it's all about communication. It's like, you know, they invented the printing press, and that meant that they could actually get the word out. It's like having the internet. They could send, you know, they could create pamphlets, and they could kind of spread news, and just how they organized. And it's just very, very interesting, very, very, inspiring work. So listen, Esther, it's really inspiring what you're doing. I'm very moved. Before I end my podcast, I ask guests a question. So the question is what does it mean to live a good life and create the good society? And I'm asking it in relation to kind of your work as an activist. And what could you share with the audience which you think is important to kind of help us live a good life and create a good society? Big questions.
I was thinking about this the other day. I was. So I think what I would say is that this is like if I'm giving advice to individual people, right? This is like if somebody asked me, like, Esther, I want to live a good life, what should I do? I would say you have to find something that you can give yourself over to. So you have to find something that you feel is more important than yourself, and you need to kind of, I think you need to give yourself over to it. Like if that's like an issue that you're really passionate about, if that's art, if that's a sport, if that's, I don't know, whatever, like you need to, I think like every person needs to have something like that. I think cultivating open-heartedness. I think that's something that I'm trying to practice in my life, especially recently. And it's something that, you know, like I said, you have to practice. You know, some people think that they're born with it or not born with it, but just in the same way that you practice riding a bike or practice like a new skill, you have to kind of practice open-heartedness. I think towards everyone and towards like the people in your life and the relationships that you have. And then I think the last thing that I'll say is that I think you need to start working on yourself in your 20s, because I think a lot of people leave it till they're like 30, 40, 50. But I think get started on it in your 20s. I think that would massively improve a lot of people's lives, in my opinion anyway. Yeah,
I mean, many of the audience will need a TARDIS to go back in time to start that journey, but I think it's great advice. And I mean just to say, some early work I did in my 20s, I got interested in therapy and stuff, and it really helped me in my 30s, my 40s, my 50s. It really did, like, you know, hugely important, like, you know. So great advice. Esther, it's been a delight having you on Edgy Ideas. Thank you very much indeed.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Simon.